Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kydraconus Books. Kydraconus Books is an independent anarchist literary press that publishes socially engaged literature. Today I'm with my usual podcast partners, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg, and we are going to talk about a pretty interesting novel called The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks, who also wrote sci-fi under the name Ian M. Banks. So it was Hans's pick, and I know he kind of intended it as maybe the third in a triptych on gender, starting with the two novels by Gore Vidal, Myra and Myra Breckenridge and Myron. So I'm going to hand it off to you, Hans, and you can, you know, start us out. What's the first thing you want to chat about?
Well, I should say technically, I guess it's the third in a, what would you call a triptych with four parts, a quadriptych? There is another book about gender that I want to talk about next time my pick comes up. So it's not the end of the line necessarily for that topic, but
my bad.
Oh, it's fine. But you are right that my interest in The Wasp Factory was partly driven by thinking about it in relationship to Myra Breckenridge and Myron, which, I mean, I think of a little bit as sort of one unit, right? But in particularly in relationship to Myra Breckenridge, which is the better and the stronger and the kind of the more memorable of those two. But yeah, I was interested in, it's funny actually, I didn't remember that there's a reference to Myra Breckenridge in The Wasp Factory, right? So Myra Breckenridge is a novel that we did for the podcast a couple months ago, and the main character is a trans woman who is attempting to, through somewhat violent and disturbing means, overturn conventional gender roles for the benefit of humanity and society. And I had thought about this novel as a follow-up to Myra Breckenridge because it's a, well, I guess we can talk a little bit about how you might define the character in contemporary terminology, but someone who is biologically born as a girl and identifies as a boy for the majority of the novel and only discovers at the end that they were born biologically a girl. But there's actually an explicit reference to Myra Breckenridge in the novel itself, right? Which is, in particular, the main character, Frank's father has convinced him that he was born a boy and had his penis torn off by a dog when he was young. And there's a passing reference in the novel to the fact that Frank's father is always buying him books and leaving the books around to try to get Frank to read them, and Frank never does because he hates his father and doesn't want to do what his father says. And one of the books that he mentions his father leaving around is Myra Breckenridge, right? So it which suggested to me that, you know, that Banks was maybe consciously, if not writing in response to Myra Breckenridge, at least conscious that he was touching on some of the same themes in maybe like a mirrored or reversed way, right? Because one thing that's interesting about Frank is that, well, I'll say this to kind of try to set up the topic for discussion now that we have this background, and I'll see if that gets us moving forward, right? But one thing that I thought is interesting about Frank as a character is that he is viciously, loathsomely dismissive of women, right? He's viciously misogynistic for most of the novel. And, I mean, in general, is a very... has a lot of issues with violence, has a lot of issues with violence against animals, right? Spends much of the novel torturing and killing animals. And at the end of the novel, kind of thinks about, and also, according at least according to his own testimony, and maybe we can talk a bit later about the reliability of Frank as a narrator, but also has, as a child, killed three different other children in ways that he managed to disguise as accidents, right? And at the end of the novel, when he discovers that he was actually born a girl, develops the theory that he acted out in those violent ways as a kind of a way of trying to overcome the sense of loss that he had from having his penis torn off, and that discovering that he never had a penis, that he was born biologically female, that completely changes his relationship to the violence in his nature. And he kind of writes that off and thinks, oh, I guess, you know, I don't, he feels as though he's shed that and immediately become a less violent and more compassionate person. And I guess the question I've been winding up to all this time is, so this is certainly a very entertaining novel, right? It's a very interesting novel. It's one of the, it's very, very not boring, right? Because it's you know, full of these right. vivid scenes of, almost murder. The whole novel is a vivid scene either of violence or of some kind of esoteric ritual connected to the violence, right? These mm-hmm. esoteric rituals of divination and prophecy that Frank does. And I guess the question is, Is there a statement here? Is there really, how much thematic meat is there here under the interest, right? Are there real weighty ideas about gender that are being tossed around here, or is it entertaining but maybe not as rich thematically as some of the other stuff that we might have looked at?
I think that a lot of it calls attention to the end of the novel, because so much, I think, is carried by that reflection mm-hmm. that the narrator has, that I kind of want to reread the novel because of how much that reflection is carrying. You know, we're not actually given a lot of time with Francis, after they discover they were born biologically female, and sort of confronting that fact about themselves, and mm-hmm. and the epiphany comes fast and hard, and I think, and maybe I'm misremembering it, but it seemed specifically, and maybe this is sort of an edifice, the edifice that you're looking for to sort of build some kind of analysis on, they say that because the ability to give life had been taken away from them, they mm-hmm. decided they had taken life, and it had even been kind of a subconscious urge. And so maybe there's something there, and I'll offer another one too, another possible avenue. It's connected, maybe it complicates it, maybe it's nothing. But it occurred to me, too, that in the midst of kind of the narrator's, like, violent ritualistic behavior, like, the majority of that behavior, or a lot of that behavior, seems to be sort of connected to this larger idea of how the world works, and the world being full of signs and systems, or being a system that is full of signs and paths that, you know, go one way or the other, that maybe, you know, mirror a little bit the wasp factory, that the machine that the narrator has set up to kind of prophesy the future by sticking a wasp in the middle of this sort of maze and sort of watching the wasp's behavior and seeing how the wasp dies. And it occurred to me at the end that that the narrator was at least maybe subconsciously aware of the way in which they had been placed similarly in a kind of controlled environment and were being kind of monitored. I guess like it would be like their world has been kind of falsified in some way, and maybe and they're within a construct sort of created by their father, and maybe they're recreating that construct on the world. Like maybe they sense it in some way, and they and I wondered about that potentially being, you know, something too, but that sort of like guided their behavior and made them lash out. I just very quickly, the first thing that I thought about with this book was Caliban Upon Setebos while reading it, because of this sort of myth making that the narrator does, and how that myth making sort of seems to manifest in a lot of violence. It's like the world is violent, the world is deceitful, the world is full of hidden passages and sacred rites of pain and dismemberment and death, and deceit, lies. And that, it seems to me, must have been informed by some sense that they were actually being manipulated in some way, though I could be, you know, maybe you guys have a different reading on that. And I wonder if that also sort of complicates the gender question, but maybe it has nothing to do with it.
I like that. Yeah, I like that as an interpretation, right? The idea that, so Frank has created this thing called the Wasp Factory that basically is built out of the face of an old like a tower clock, and the wasp is put into the factory, and the wasp kind of has a set of choices it's been given, and which of the choices the wasp chooses, each of the rooms in the face of the clock corresponds to some sort of death, and the method of death that the wasp chooses is an omen of some kind, right? And your idea is that that Frank is kind of reenacting in miniature this way in which he has been put into his father's own experiment, right? That the urge to kind of create these artificial conditions for things to destroy themselves in meaningful ways is replicating what his father has done. That does make a lot of sense to me, yeah. As to how much it connects to the, I don't know if it connects directly to the gender question. I mean, the idea of gender is tied up in it to the extent that Frank is, it's tied up in it to the extent that the manipulation of Frank's gender is the mechanism that was used to construct kind of the larger version of a wasp factory that Frank has grown up in, right? It seems like there's a lot of, and maybe you guys might be more familiar with a full understanding of these terms, right? But it seems like there's almost a kind of maybe gender essentialism that Frank is subscribing to, right? Like there's a way in which Frank discovering that in some sense he thinks of himself as belonging to a different gender, right? Like the way that Frank reads it on some level is not, and you maybe this is something that maybe this is something you guys read differently, right? But Frank's reading is not, oh, I've always been a boy, but I'm discovering that I was a boy who was trapped in a girl's biological body, right? Frank's reading is much more, huh, I always thought I was a boy, but I guess I'm a girl. Right? And so there's an immediate shift that seems to manifest in Frank's personality upon making that discovery, right? And is that Frank buying into ideas of essentialism in maybe too easy a way? Is that maybe on some level Frank trying to look for an out to some of the sort of violence that he's built up around himself? Is that, I guess I don't know how to read his reaction to that at the end, either thematically or within the realm of what the character, who the character is, you know?
I feel like the question of whether or not, like, Frank is giving enough, is able, I don't think that Frank just doesn't have, like, nature has not taught Frank to see gender as a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And he, or they rather, have not, they don't have the infrastructure in their mind to not maybe think of this as anything more than a toggle switch.
Okay.
That would be my answer. As far as like Frank just sort of gravitating immediately to a female identity rather than, you know, anywhere like any other sort of more nuanced perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I also think I think that a lot of maybe that essentialist ideals or ideas rather about gender, I'm trying to think, do they come from the father in some way? Even if Frank thinks they are consciously rejecting, you know, their father and their father's weirdness and weakness and all the things that Frank hates about them, Frank sort of unconsciously adopts a lot of the things that, like, really defines the fathers, such as what seems to be a deep hatred or mistrust of women.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that just sort of sets up an understanding of men and women as just extremely distinct in some way. That's part, I think that what you're getting at is part of almost a problem I had with the end of the book, which is we spend so much time reading about why women are weak and terrible, and then Frank discovers they are biologically anyway intact as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that felt like it didn't get resolved to me. And maybe it's not meant to be, but it did seem extraordinarily sudden.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the question that I came out of on a second reading of the novel was whether that suddenness and that lack of examination is a feature or a flaw, right? Whether the way that, like you said, that Frank kind of responds to this with a toggle switch, the way in which it comes about so abruptly, as much as anything else, is a way of resolving this impending conflict with Frank's insane brother, right? And I just wasn't sure I wasn't sure whether there was some additional level of critique in that, or if it was maybe to some extent just the product of it being it's a first novel, it's short, it's seems to have been written with the pretty conscious intention of being as striking and shocking as possible, right? And how much of that was just, it's not kind of in the aesthetic structure of the novel to have that level of examination, right? I don't know, but it seemed I wasn't sure how much that the, especially reading it again. I read it a second time for this podcast, and reading it a second time, of course, I knew ahead of time the secret at the end, and I was wondering if knowing the secret at the end would lend some kind of extra thematic depth or dimension to some of the things that happen in the course of the novel. And it, to me, it didn't necessarily seem like it did, right? It doesn't, other than a few little things like catching the reference to Myra Breckinridge, the sort of the abruptness, the toggle, the lack of examination around the deeper meaning of that was still there. And I don't even mean to say that that's bad relative to the quality of the novel in terms of what it's doing as a freestanding work, right? I don't think that makes it less interesting. I don't think it makes it less creative. I don't think that it makes it less vivid or memorable. It just makes it a little bit harder to dig into on a podcast where you've picked it to talk about the theme of gender in a novel, right?
Yeah. Good job, Hans.
Yeah. I kind of fucked the dog on this one.
No.
At least you didn't set him on fire.
At least
that is you know, at least there wasn't dog sex in this. There wasn't bestiality that I remember.
No
but there was plenty of animal murder, which
there was terrible crime. I mean, like, I have a question, Patrick, like, you're a deeply moral person, like,
you wrote an essay once about the importance of not killing ants when they walk into the sink, right? I started rereading, you know, when I got to the scene where he roasts rabbits alive, where he like shoots fire into rabbit burrows and watches them run around.
Yeah, that
shrieking.
Was fucked up.
I thought, boy, I don't know that I'm recommending this to someone whose level of conscience around animal murder is so developed. I maybe did not make the best choice here in terms of Patrick's aesthetic, right?
No, it's all right. I'm, you know, I am not as much of a, I mean, I do think that when we were all together in Alaska, that I was a very, strict, prudish person, but I don't feel that I'm actually that way anymore.
Okay.
So this didn't bother me in, you know, the sense that, you know, because I especially care about animal murder, it's just, it was gruesome and fucked up. And
sure.
anybody can see that who has a functioning, you know, ethical mechanism in their head, right?
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that the animal murder, I think, maybe just because of the nature of death, right? But like seems like the animal murder is actually more shocking in here than the child murder.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more, I was definitely disturbed when, you know, like, Frank is like, oh yeah, and I've killed three kids who were related to me. But definitely the murders themselves seemed less sadistic, I guess. Like, one seemed like, I'm going to get you back for something. What did his cousin do that he didn't like?
Killed his rabbits.
Oh, okay. And then the second one was, I've got to put my brother out of his misery. Right?
Well, I got to kill my brother because he is the reincarnation of the dog who unmanned me.
Oh, right. Okay, I had to. I didn't quite work that out because you don't find out until later that, like, the dog's skull is all about.
And then the little girl, which was the most disturbing murder to me, but
oh
also
yeah, absolutely
really beautiful. But like, good
just
God,
just floats her away, and she probably at some point just dropped into the sea and drowned.
Or just died of exposure, being, like, you know, exposed.
But the child murders all The child murders all have kind of an Edward Gorey quality to them almost, you know, like they have this sort of gothic humor quality, and they're presented with these little comic touches, like the way that he phonetically renders his 5-year-old brother's accent right before his brother whacks a bomb with a board and blows himself up, right?
All right.
The animal murders are just kind of vicious violence.
Yeah, the vicious violence. And not to be too cute about it, but I mean, is there some question as to whether these murders actually happened the way that...
That's something I wanted to ask, yeah. How reliable of a narrator, particularly in regard to that violence, the Frank really is.
I mean, Frank is at one point suddenly convinced that his father has been a woman all this time. And so I'm just sort of... Frank is very, very convinced of their own authority and perceptiveness, but is not, like, I mean, I guess, like, objectively is really confused about the world around them.
Well, that's that situation seemed at least understandable, like, well,
the confusion,
I don't know,
is reasonable, yeah, yeah.
The confusion in that case is reasonable.
Totally understandable, but like it makes me wonder because of, I guess, like you said, at the Edward Goriness of this, of the sort of dreamlike quality of those murders. It's very easy. It seems almost more realistic that like a child would remember. Would kind of transpose playing with a snake and then like the death of the tragic death of this boy, and all of the murders, you know, like are, you know, the human murders are really like not like Frank's not implicated. They're not implicated, but the part of that's because the actual death happened. You know, like there, no one would bother implicating them. It's like,
do you know,
you purpose? Sorry, go ahead.
The thing about the murders, and I'm having a thought here that I'm gonna try to convey, and maybe this will fall flat, maybe it won't, right? But like, the murders are all, by my understanding of criminology, they're all murders that a woman would do, right? Like if you look at women, if you look at in crime statistics, how women and men murder, right? Men murder with direct application of violence and force. They shoot, they stab, they beat. Women poison you, right? These murders are all, they're not through direct application of violence. They're all through these kind of cunning stratagems to expose people to hazards. And that's, at least according to like a sort of blurred stereotypical way of understanding criminology, those are, the snake in particular, right? Like poisoning someone, like if a woman's going to kill you, she poisons you, right? According to like my rough understanding of like, of how crime statistics function. Obviously there are exceptions to all this, but within the realm of, within the relatively kind of binary way that gender is understood in this novel, it kind of does make sense that if Frank were going to kill, if by his own understanding, right, he's secretly been a woman the whole time, then murdering in a stereotypically feminine way kind of makes a sort of a subterranean kind of sense, you know? Maybe I'm reading too much into that, I don't know.
No, I think that's interesting, and it doesn't necessarily lend credence to my doubt that these murders occurred actually, like that, you know, that these children died and Frank was there, and Frank was a child and memory is mercurial, and Frank is very self-destructive.
I mean, I do actually, I there's not a whole lot of room for nuance or subtlety around this because the novel is, it's short and it's thin, right? I feel like there's not a lot of room to cast ambiguity. That being said, though, I don't remember for sure. Do any of the other characters actually mention the existence of any of the dead children? Does the father ever say the name of the dead brother or the dead cousin or the dead other cousin? Or is
Paul,
there any proof?
Maybe Paul.
Maybe Paul. I can't remember for sure. But I wonder how much proof we have that any of these three characters existed outside of Frank's recollection. I don't think that necessarily would argue one way or the other, but I feel like maybe Paul is mentioned by another character, though, now that I think about it. But certainly not the cousins, right? And the other thing, too, that seems to me like you could maybe read it as casting doubt on Frank's reliability as a narrator is he seems so cowed by his brother, right? His brother who is coming, the whole conflict of the novel in the kind of present moment of the action of the novel, the whole conflict of it is I can't remember the brother's name, but the brother has gone crazy and done these incidents of violence that in the village, mostly setting fire to dogs, and the brother's coming back and they're going to have some kind of confrontation, right? And when Frank talks to their brother on the phone, there's so much force that Frank has in solitude. And as soon as Frank comes into contact with another being, as soon as Frank is really interacting with what's definitely another human being, there's no pushback at all against the kind of anger and loudness and violence of the brother on the phone. And that's interesting to me, right? And I mean, I guess maybe it makes sense that there's a psychological dynamic you have with your older brother that is different, right? But Frank is such a powerful person in the realm that he lives in for the bulk of the novel. Frank presents himself as such a powerful person in the realm that he exists in for the bulk of the novel. And then but then is so scared by this other, like, objectively there's no reason that Frank really should be frightened by, like, Frank has done so much to fortify the island. Frank has weapons. Frank has, you know, the knowledge of being a killer in a way that the brother isn't. And it's interesting that Frank doesn't meet that with more authority or force.
Frank is pretty cowardly around other people. I mean, Frank doesn't even urinate in the presence of another person. It seems to me like Frank doesn't do so. I mean, there's a lot of retreat in Frank, mm-hmm. When it comes to external characters who we know are there,
right?
Such as the friend, and that's, you know, maybe that supports like what you're saying about, you know, Eric, and it isn't just that Eric is kind of deified by Frank, because Eric's the older brother. It's because Frank is actually secretly not a very brave person. Not as strong of a person as they would like to think they are.
But I don't know. I mean, that lack of strength in the present tense events of the novel, I don't know if that lack of strength can be read to signal that maybe the murders are an invention, or if the lack of strength is connected to the kind of the odd scheming passive aggressive nature of the murders, or if it, I mean, the murders are very cunning. I don't mean to talk the murders down, and maybe they have to be cunning to evade detection. Right. But I think of all the things in the novel that you could read as casting Frank as an unreliable narrator, that inability to project force with any other real definite person is, to me, seems like the strongest.
I don't
do think he
that
really
Paul
does torch those rabbits, though.
Yeah, I mean that's they're rabbits. And that he doesn't have to be. I mean, that's true. Frank has a battle with a rabbit. Frank is a 17-year-old person. Certainly rabbits are, you know, a wild animal can be very ferocious, but I'm...
Well, jackrabbits, you know, are huge.
Jimmy Carter was attacked by a rabbit in a rowboat, you may recall. Had to fight it off in the war.
Jimmy Carter?
President Jimmy Carter. Yeah, Jimmy Carter. I think there might even be video footage of this, I think. Or maybe it was just an anecdote he told. But Jimmy Carter was alone in a rowboat in the middle of a lake. And a rabbit came swimming toward him at great speed with, you know, murder in its eyes. And tried to climb aboard the boat and bite him. And he had to fight it off with an oar.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, if that snowflake survived, if Jimmy Carter, that soft, liberal, no, I'm kidding. Jimmy Carter is one of the kindest, most giving presidents maybe we've ever had.
Well, let's
not,
let's,
not the toughest,
I mean,
competition, but
he was a fucking president who probably bombed people. So
his whole post-presidential career has been an extended act of charitable service.
No. If there is a president to respect, it might be him. But like your typical like backyard rabbit is not the same thing as one of these huge wild jackrabbits. Those things are giant and will bite your finger off.
Yeah, with Carter.
Well, maybe
with Carter,
I was gonna say like the most like brutal fight in the book is between our narrator and a rabbit.
Yeah.
And with Carter,
and
it was
maybe
a swamp,
I'm being
rabbit.
Unkind to the rabbits.
I'd add stuff. I have no idea about any of this. Like, I don't know what
Patrick.
I don't know what it's saying about gender. I don't know what it's saying about being a weird serial killer. I don't know what it's saying about anything. It's not an unreliable narrator.
You trust the narrator mostly?
Well, I just think that if the narrator is unreliable, then there are going to be clear signs. And there's not really any clear... I mean, you know, I feel like you guys are looking for things. Like, maybe, you know, because it's an interesting idea. But I don't... I think that what the narrator talks about is real within the world of the novel. This novel, anyway.
Do you think, then, that the narrator at the end is a more moral person? Because I was thinking about, like... feature or bug of the reflection at the end, Hans. And one of the features that came to mind is that it does sort of, it's self-mythologizing in a lot of the ways that what has come before is self-mythologizing, but it may not really change anything about, I mean, does that really mean that this person is just sort of suddenly like not a murderer? I mean, they can pivot on a dime, apparently, about like their motivation, you know, and like their sense of self and everything like that. But like, is learning some fundamental like aspect of yourself, learning something, some fundamental aspect of yourself is a lie, and then like remapping your identity. Like, I think we'd like to think that maybe that has a lot to do with behavior, but like, does it really just sort of like wipe away, maybe like this person is still a psychopath, is a psychopath.
I wasn't, right? I was not convinced by the line at the end where Frank says, you know, well, I guess I was a girl. That must be the reason why I did all this. I still don't want to be around this person. I do not want this person to fucking get some weird idea in their head and kill one of my kids. No thanks.
You wouldn't hire Frank as a babysitter.
Right, exactly. wouldn't hire Frank for fucking anything.
Other than Hitman, maybe. But
sure.
Well, yeah. I do think that maybe the evidence for an unreliable narrator isn't strongly presented enough, or isn't strong enough that it's not strong enough to really change much of anything, you know. I think that it's interesting that the way that the gender discovery changes Frank's relationship to her brother, and that moment where the image at the end of the novel where the brother is resting, I believe they're sitting together and the brother has his head in Frank's lap, right? And has fallen asleep with his head in Frank's lap. And it's such a gentle image. And if nothing else, it does something about that discovery seems to have completely neutralized this violent tension between the two, right? And caused Frank to respond to the brother in this nurturing manner that immediately dissipates this kind of horrifying energy and violence that's built up throughout the novel. How plausible that is, how credible that is, I don't know if that is, maybe that's an aesthetic failure of the novel, that's so abrupt, maybe that's not believable, maybe the compressed way in which that happens is by design, I don't know, but just within the evidence of events in the novel, it does seem like Frank's relationship to the world is changed completely in a positive way by that discovery. But maybe I'm oversimplifying that. I don't know.
Well, I think that Frank believes that it's changed.
Do you think that there's an important... Is there an important distinction between Frank believing it's changed and it changing? Is something else needed to change it? I mean, maybe it's concerning, perhaps, that Frank is not... Frank's thought isn't, okay, now I have remorse for that bad thing I did to those three kids. It's just, I guess that's why I did it, and I don't need to do it anymore, right? So the lack of remorse is troublesome, maybe.
So I guess, In a lot of serial killers, there's compulsion, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think have you guys heard of BTK, the bind, torture, kill guy?
Oh yeah,
Richard,
he's a local.
Richard Rader. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think
you're talking to Washingtonians, man. we know our murderers.
Okay. So I swear that he has said that he should be put away because he will continue to do what he does because it's compulsory. So for the narrator, we could have this seeming epiphany at the end, but we still might have these compulsions continue on. Now, granted, that's just like, you know, some kind of pop psychology, but it seems reasonable that if it seems reasonable to me to wonder if there's a difference between the narrator's perception, like there's this perception that things have changed, but are these compulsions to commit violence going to surface again?
I think, and I'll jump in to say that, like, the narrator's not planning on killing any. Is says outright that they don't plan on killing humans anymore.
Mm.
Early on in the book, too. So it's not like
that's true.
So I'm agreeing with you, Patrick. I think that, like, I also think that's it's kind of an interesting, maybe delicate, like, line. We can trust the narrator and say that the narrator is reliable in describing what happens to them and about their own perceptions of what is going on, while acknowledging the fact that the narrator has so far been pretty shitty at understanding what's going on.
Right, sure.
Understanding
sure.
The rationale for their behavior, you mean?
Bring
Yeah.
That
I understand. Go ahead.
The point we're making, the stance you're taking, Patrick, is that Frank is a reliable documenter of events, but Frank's statement about their own motivations, mindset, and plans for future action are not as reliable as their statement of events that have happened.
That's probably what I'm saying, yes. Like the analyses that Frank brings to bear on the situation, on all kinds of situations, does tend to, like you say, Chris, fail in the end. Even if you know the narrative itself, we have pretty good reason to believe is real. Frank doesn't seem to be able to create, identify the important elements of meaning within that narrative.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So then relative to the question of gender and ideas of gender in the novel, if the end of the novel is Frank discovering this thing about their gender identity that they believe to completely change their relationship to the world and to the violence that they do or don't do in the world, but that revelation, that epiphany, is untrustworthy and false, then to some extent that becomes a critique of overly shallow or binary ideas about gender.
And specifically, that actually makes me think that it is a critical response to Myra Breckinridge itself, which, I don't want to say, you know, if in Myra, like, there's this on-off switch between mm-hmm. the Myron personalities, like, you know, Myra is this, you know, kind of sadistic, you know, woman kind of bent on revenge, and Myron is this simplistic, all-American, you know, patriot
square guy.
Square.
Yeah.
Then it seems to me that the Wasp Factory might be pointing out that formulation itself is not a very realistic one or a very positive one.
It is interesting that
with Myron Breckinridge.
Yeah, go on. And I don't know how much that name dropping of Myra Breckinridge is meant to be an actual dialogue or critique versus how much it's just a sort of an Easter egg, right?
Right.
But it is interesting that to think about the ways that Frank and Myra are distinct as characters, because Frank, I mean, Myra Breckinridge is, like you said, the female aspect of Myra / Myron, the Myra person is so sadistic, so violent, so someone who does in fact act with force upon the world in a way that Frank wishes to but doesn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Myra actually, if nothing else, Myra acts and behaves in ways that are completely contrary to Frank's sense both before and after their discovery of their real biology. Myra's femininity exists in a way that is completely opposed to Frank's idea of the feminine, right?
Mm.
And I think it's probably a stretch to say that the Wasp Factory is meant somehow to refute or rebut Myra Breckinridge, but
right.
I do think it's interesting that the ways in which the sort of the polarities are inverted between the two, right? Where in Myra Breckinridge, the feminine is in fact associated with force and sadism and violence, and the opposite is true in the Wasp Factory.
Hmm.
Is that a good place to wrap up?
I think we solved it, folks.
Did we? I mean, I don't feel like we solved it, but
I think that with you, Patrick, you kind of delineating between, because I think that delineating between the reliability of events and also but then the reliability of motivation,
mm-hmm.
made me think specifically of Paul. But you know, like the motivation behind Paul's murder, the girl's murder, like those feel so like not real.
Mm.
And I'd have to like look throughout the rest of the book at some of the other violence and things like that, but like I really am comfortable not like sort of settling on a fixed interpretation, but I'm definitely comfortable like coming away from this book feeling as though the narrator is still paying attention to signs and in a kind of a larger sort of imagined system,
mm-hmm.
of doorways and pathways,
sure,
that doesn't actually map onto the real world,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
and feels as though maybe they have stepped into, you know, a new hallway in a larger wasp factory that means something entirely different, but actually is not as meaningful as they believe.
Right.
You know, they feel like they're navigating something, and then that navigation means something, and alternating and changing, you know, gender or these, you know, like these supposedly the big distinctions actually sort of like make changes that are mean substantively different enough things that they will, you know, manifest in a different fate, mm-hmm. or different behavior. And I feel like Eric is maybe like just a sort of a symbol of why all of that is sort of meaningless. Like Eric, and I don't know, like the reason Eric went insane is extraordinarily vivid, but then like there's other stuff going on, and I just don't think that there's I guess I don't trust that simplistic idea of the world either.
Mm.
So basically the narrator at the end feeling as though they've kind of like walked, they've changed in some fundamental way, I don't trust it. And I don't trust the narrator in that particular way.
Something you just said, I feel like kind of made my mind explode a little bit. So you pointed out, like, you said that what makes Eric go insane is extremely vivid. And I was thinking that maybe there's some point in the novel, I don't know what that point is, but there's some bit of a core or nexus or a little node of interest to be mined or explored in the idea that the maggots in the little baby's head and the supposed incident where the dog chomps off Frank's genitalia, these are catalysts, right? These are catalysts for, in the former case, Eric's insanity, and in the latter case, Frank's descent into sociopathic violence. But the question I have is, these are just catalysts, right? Like, that's how trauma and disorder works in the real world. There are all these different factors in your history that lean you in one way or another, and then something catalyzes them, something triggers them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, I feel like I've maybe lost to what I was trying to say, but I'm wondering, is there something meaningful in that, in this idea of these incidents, how they parallel one another, and if that reflects on what you're saying, Chris?
I think that that's a kind of a good way of putting it, you know, like the catalyst, or it's like you hurt your back. It's not actually the, you know, like the, it's like, why did I hurt my back reaching out and grabbing that can of water, you know, like, or beer. It's like, no, actually you injured your back all these other times. It's just that was a catalyst for the pain and the seizing right. up and all of that. And I think that, you know, I wondered about that too, because like, you know, Eric is like a doctor, and doctors see
right.
like awful stuff like all the time. And I thought about the way that, I guess I'll say, like the way that I think about it is that if you believe that the world is comprised of symbols and clear pathways, and that your life is basically like in some sort of maze, but that the maze itself can be seen and recognized, and you can look back on the moment things went wrong, and or like you took the wrong turn, right. or this or that thing happened to you, it seems like a maybe resultant from a mind right, right, that right. is fixated on that. Like if, you know, you wonder if Eric was actually asked about it, Eric would be like, oh, I forgot about the kid with the maggots. Like,
right.
you know, yeah, that was awful. But like, you know, there was other shit going on.
Right,
you know,
right.
Like, because they mentioned like he was doing poorly in school. He had just broken up with somebody, you know, like there was a lot that like is basically, I think, understood through Frank's desire to understand the world that way.
Right, right. I think what I'm talking about mirrors this Frank having these signs and symbols and pulling revelations out of these signs and symbols, and it's just a made up system, and like these, you know, the onset of insanity in Eric and violence in Frank, these really don't have as much meaning as...
Ooh. Yeah, sorry.
What happened?
No, I just... It. Frank is broken. Frank's looking for a story for why
Frank is broken.
But Frank is broken. Frank has always been broken.
Right.
I guess like you were... Like you already realized.
Right, right.
That,
that's what I was trying to get. Like, you know, typically when we talk about being a sociopath or being a serial killer, we're you know, these are things that you're born with inherent tendencies genetically or chromosomally or however you want to call it. And then there are these environmental stimuli that you know, lead you down one path or another. And so what the catalyst is isn't as important as, you know, Frank's being broken or Eric's being broken already. And then later on, they're just applying symbols to it, or rather Frank is.
So Frank is broken. Frank looks for stories to explain a brokenness that is in fact inherent, and one manifestation of that is telling this story that explains Eric's brokenness, when in fact that story is only, that story isn't necessarily explanatory, and might not have the same power for Eric himself.
Yeah. As usual, Hans, you're able to summarize it precisely and succinctly. That's a
get fucked, Hans.
No.
Get fucked. We did all the work.
I was trying to compliment you and point out that you have a quality that I'm envious of.
Yeah.
You guys did the hard part there.
Not to say get fucked. Although both of you can get fucked. Not really.
Yeah, it's hopeful. It's a hopeful message. Go out. Get fucked.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, yeah.
Anyway, I think we can finalize with that message. Go out and get fucked, right?
Like, it's hopeful.
Yeah.
I mean, in the positive way.
That's a good,
I think that, like,
it's a good semicolon to the podcast, right? Until next time, go get fucked. Right? is that reasonable?
I think so.
All right.
I think so.
All right. Okay.
Really, really good choice, Hans. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. It was a super good book. I found myself very puzzled at the beginning of our conversation, just because I don't know. Like, I had no idea how I thought it all fit together. And I had the inkling that maybe it didn't, but since we've created a wasp factory here to describe the wasp factory, I now feel like we have. Right?
Excellent.
I do.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, everybody, thank you for listening. Next time, our next podcast is going to discuss Kai Drakonis Books' most recent publication, the novel The Sodomites, which is, you know, in a nutshell, deals with issues surrounding Israeli apartheid. So it's pretty good book, and one thing I like about it is it's explicitly anarchist. So it actually, this would be our first publication that is explicitly dealing with anarchism, and as an anarchist, I find that interesting. So we're gonna have the author on to talk about The Sodomites. So everybody who listens, you can look forward to our next podcast on The Sodomites, in which we will talk to the author themselves. Peace out, everyone. Until next time.